Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
I'm Julia Paskin. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. That's April 25th at the Crawford. Tickets at las.com/events.
From the 1968 concert at the Hollywood Bowl, The Doors, of course, Jim Morrison singing Light My Fire. We turn our attention now to the very latest on COVID-19. Joining us, Professor of Nursing and Public Health at UCLA and registered nurse practicing at Gateways Hospital in Echo Park, Professor Kristen R. Choi. Professor, it's so good to have you back with us on Air Talk.
Good morning, Larry.
So let's start first about where we are on the cases. We just heard a woman calling in expressing concern. She thought the cases might be going up. It looked fairly level to me here in California. What are you seeing in terms of the case rates?
That's absolutely right, Larry. At the moment, our cases are looking pretty good here in LA, and I'm cautiously optimistic that we are going to continue making progress on vaccinations and potentially head off some of the outbreaks that we're seeing in other states over on the East Coast, like New York and Michigan. In some of those other states, a lot of the rises in cases are tied particularly to the UK variant of the coronavirus. Currently in Southern California, we don't have many cases of those variants yet. So again, I'm cautiously optimistic. Of course, that could change quickly. We know that these variants are unpredictable and have spread in many ways. But at the moment, our case rates are looking really good. And, you know, we're making really good progress towards progressing through the tier system to more reopening here in Southern California. Huge part of that is also increases in vaccination rates.
All right. And Professor Choi, one of the things we've seen in the few states, the four or five states that have recently seen elevated number of cases, is that these are largely younger people, unvaccinated young people. Why do you think to this point, knock on wood, we've not seen this in California?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, in California, I think that we have gotten a lot of older people vaccinated, of course, as well as some people who are younger who fall into those categories of healthcare workers, frontline workers, people who live in group homes, apartments, all those kinds of things. We are seeing some younger people getting vaccinated. I think part of it, too, is that in California, we've had really strict guidelines that we've been following and have been closed longer than some of these other states with pretty strict guidelines for social distancing, masking, et cetera. It's really exciting to see that we're very close to having vaccinations open up even more to younger folks, and it'll be very important that our older teens, college students, those in their 20s, 30s, 40s, that all of those people are able to get the vaccines, because that is where we see a lot of the spread happening right now.
Professor Choi, we were just talking with Chad Smith, the CEO of the LA Phil, about the Hollywood Bowl's reopening. Your thoughts about the potential come the middle of June for the bowl to fully reopen at full capacity. What are your thoughts about the safety of that if they're given the go-ahead to do that?
Yeah, well, certainly that would be really exciting to see venues like the Hollywood Bowl open back up. Again, as I said earlier, I am cautiously optimistic that we will be in a really good place by June and that we'll continue to keep our case rates low. Certainly, I think that as we think about having larger public gatherings like that, even ones that are outside like the Hollywood Bowl, it'll be very important that those venues think about how to make sure that people are vaccinated or that they have had a negative COVID test. And I think that's something that can really help make those gatherings safer. Certainly masking can help as well as limited capacity. But again, I'm optimistic that we will continue the positive trajectory we're on towards reopening, towards vaccination, and ways to do that safely.
We're talking with Professor at UCLA, Professor of Nursing and Public Health, Kristen R. Choi. If you have questions for her about COVID-19, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, KPECC. KPCC.org. For many younger people here in the greater Los Angeles area, Professor, we're seeing them go up to Bakersfield, where there's been large numbers of appointments available for COVID-19 vaccination, people driving to the high desert and other places to get vaccination. What's fascinating to me is seeing how some places it's very difficult to get an appointment, and other places they have more vaccine than, at least for a period of time, they know what to do with. Is much of this driven by vaccine hesitancy in certain places like the Central Valley of California?
Yes, I think that's absolutely the case. A lot of polls have shown that whether or not people want to get vaccines falls along political lines, and that actually Republican men are among those who are least likely to want to get a vaccine. So this excess supply, I think, is due to a lot of people in these areas perhaps not knowing enough about the vaccines to feel confident about getting them. And this presents sort of two competing issues. On the one hand, we certainly don't want to see any doses going to waste. We are still in a place where demand dramatically exceeds supply, and so we want those doses to get into people's arms. At the same time, though, we need to think about how we can reach out to these groups that are maybe a little bit more hesitant about the vaccines to make sure that they have information about them and access to get them, because it is very important that we distribute the vaccines equitably.
All right. And Professor, Long Beach, just about a week before the state is opening up vaccination appointments to everyone 16 and older in California, Long Beach doing that today. So this is an opportunity for them. It seems like they've been about a week or 2 weeks ahead of everybody else when it comes to provision of a vaccine. And I'm wondering to what you would attribute that. Is that the organizational skill of their public health department? Is it just them deciding they're going to open it up to wider groups, but maybe appointments are harder to get? What do you make of that?
Yeah, Long Beach certainly has been a little bit ahead of Los Angeles in terms of really the whole process of the pandemic. And it's fantastic to see them getting to this point where the vaccine can be opened up to everyone who's eligible by age. I think that all of those factors play a role. Certainly, it's a bit smaller and less complicated of a city than Los Angeles. And they have an excellent public health department there, and they have put a lot of effort into the logistics and planning. Here in Los Angeles, you know, our vaccine distribution system is fairly complicated. There are sites run by the city, by the county, by individual clinics and hospitals. And LA is just, as we all know, a big and complicated city. So I think that it is probably smaller size and logistics that have allowed them to get to this place sooner. And hopefully LA will be shortly behind.
Pfizer just tweeted on its verified Twitter account, "Today with BioNTech Group, we submitted a request to US FDA to expand emergency use of our COVID-19 vaccine to adolescents 12 to 15 years of age. We plan to request similar rulings by other regulatory authorities worldwide in coming days. Pending regulatory decision, our hope is to make this vaccine available to the 12 to 15-year-old age group before the start of the 2021 school year." You can learn more about our study in this filing, and they have a link to it. Your thoughts on Pfizer just making this announcement?
I think it's absolutely appropriate for them to submit for emergency use authorization for the vaccine in this younger group. We recently saw results from their clinical trial with teens ages 12 and above that the vaccine was very safe and very effective at preventing COVID-19. And so absolutely, I think it's really wonderful to see this moving forward so that we can get it to some of these teens. As we know, you know, in order for us to get to herd immunity in the U.S., we will need some children and teens to get this vaccine. Children and teens make up about a quarter of the population in the U.S., and so given that some adults will probably decline, we will need that group to get this vaccine to be involved. Certainly, we also know that having teens get vaccinated will help us have our schools reopen safely. So I'm excited to see this coming out and hope that it can be authorized soon after, of course, review by the FDA so that we can start getting it out to younger teens who we know can have this vaccine safely.
We have many more questions for her, and if you have ones for her as well, please join us 866-893-KPECC. You can tweet at AirTalk, post on the AirTalk Facebook page, or post on the AirTalk blog page, kpecc.org. We're speaking with UCLA Professor of Nursing and Public Health. She's also a practicing registered nurse at Gateway's Hospital, Kristen R. Choi. We'll be back with Professor Choi in just 90 seconds on Air Talk. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's Film Week. We'll talk with Christy Lemire and Andy Klein as they review the week's movies. And our John Horn interviews the director of that documentary about the Operation Varsity Blues scandal involving paying and making donations to get kids admitted to elite schools. That's coming up on Film Week right here on KPCC. Right now, we have the very latest on COVID-19 with Kristen R. Choi, Professor of Nursing and Public Health at UCLA. Professor, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has published in JAMA's online journal a study of reactions to the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, and it found that following a second dose of those two mRNA vaccines, 82% of Moderna recipients reported an adverse reaction. Pfizer recipients were about 69% reported a reaction. I presume that can be anything from a sore arm to full-blown flu-like symptoms that put someone in bed.
Yeah, there are kind of two big camps of side effects or reactions that we look for after these vaccines. So one is local reactions. Those would be reactions right at the site where you got that injection, things like redness, pain, swelling happening right where that injection happened. Then we also have systemic reactions, and those would be those flu-like symptoms that we see for some people after getting a vaccine, things like fever, chill, headache, and maybe more widespread muscle pain. So what has been found as these vaccines have been given to more and more people, millions now, is actually consistent with what was found in the very earliest studies about the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines last summer. It was true after the trials that folks who got the Moderna vaccine had slightly higher rates of side effects than the Pfizer, but in both cases, they're very similar. The most common side effects are relatively innocuous. They're usually pain at the site, fatigue and a headache are the most common, and for most people, they pass in just a day or two. And, you know, the rates are fairly comparable, even though we do see that Moderna is a bit higher.
A new study looking at down the road what the effect of COVID infection is on patients shows that 1 in 10 still have lingering symptoms months after they have recovered from the most significant symptoms of their illness. What is the thought about what's likely happening in those with these longer lasting symptoms?
Yeah, these longer-term COVID symptoms are definitely a concern, and it's something that I think we will learn more about as time goes on, and we start to see how different people have been affected by having this disease. We know that the coronavirus targets our blood cells, and that can manifest in damage to our bodies in a whole lot of different areas. For some people, it's respiratory. For some people, it's gastrointestinal systems. For some people, they lose that sense of taste and smell, and so we do need more research to determine what this will look like for people over the long term. And certainly these early studies are starting to suggest that COVID is not necessarily just a one-time infection and something that goes away quickly. It can affect people much longer. I think one of the more concerning things I've seen as well is some recent research from the UK showing that people who have had COVID are at higher risk for having mental illness after having COVID, that a lot of people are at risk for depression and anxiety. And so as we think about these long-term COVID symptoms, I think it's very important that we also consider the mental health side of that and what it looks like to help folks recover in terms of their mental health.
Yeah, and so to your knowledge, are there groups forming, for example, of people with longer-lasting symptoms to sort of talk with other people to feel like they're not so alone?
You know, I haven't seen a lot of this happening in a widespread way. However, I think that's a really great idea. We know that social support and getting support from peers can be really effective for mental illness and a really effective way to deliver evidence-based kinds of therapy. So I hope that we'll see more of those sorts of studies coming out. At the moment, most of what I've seen is really just tracking what happens to people, less focused on what we could do about it. But those studies about what we can do about it will be absolutely needed in the coming weeks and months.
I have have an LAPD officer who just emailed me and said many officers, including myself, were hesitant to get the vaccine because, one, it's a moderately new virus we're still learning about. Two, we rushed to produce a vaccine for this new virus we're still learning about. Three, it's easy to believe the government is holding back on certain side effects for the greater good of herd immunity. And four, I believe the longer we wait, the better and safer these vaccines will become. So he wants to know sort of what you say to those like him who share those concerns, which at least he's describing as fairly widespread among law enforcement officers.
Sure. You know, I think that's a really reasonable concern. I've heard this from a lot of people, that a lot of people's most common concern is that we don't know long-term effects of the vaccines. They are new and they were developed quickly. And, you know, what I would say to this officer or to other folks who might be weighing those same decisions is that I think it's important to look at the data on the risks about these vaccines versus the long-term risks of COVID. You know, we just talked about this research coming out showing that for people who have COVID, it can be serious and it can last longer than just a simple infection that it can sometimes seem like. And I would also say that the data on the studies, even though they came out quickly and we did them quickly, they were held to the same standard as all other vaccines in the past that have come before them. And there's a very high bar of independent reviewers to verify the data and to approve them for emergency use that I feel confident in as a researcher and a nurse. So, you know, again, I think it's okay to have those concerns. And I would just encourage folks to think about potential risks of COVID and what we're risking by not getting the vaccine, in addition to thinking about the vaccines themselves and what we know about them.
Professor Choi, I need to break, but just real quickly, what do you think the prospects are for booster shots to the current vaccines that more specifically and directly address the variants as they develop?
Yeah, so I actually just got a booster dose myself as part of Pfizer's study. We know that Pfizer and Moderna are both testing them actively. Johnson & Johnson is developing, not quite testing yet, but I think that we'll learn more about these booster doses and whether they're needed. In this case, for Pfizer and Moderna, they have both been targeted specifically for the strain first found in South Africa. So we should know more soon. Those studies are active and happening now.
Very good. Thank you so much, Professor Choi. Pleasure to talk with you again and have a wonderful weekend. Professor of Nursing and Public Health at UCLA, Kristen Choi, joining us. She's also a registered nurse practicing at Gateway's Hospital in Echo Park. Coming up, it's Los Angeles Times columnist Pat Morrison, who's going to share with us her thoughts about the passing of Prince Philip, who died at the age of 99. Remarkable life and figure. We'll hear from Pat in just 1 minute.
Support comes from Ciclovia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclovia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclovia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.